The lecture this evening focuses on Rav Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha, as a philosopher. It's quite rare that I have the privilege to focus on that aspect of the Rav's thought. Usually that's a quick soporific. The Rav is probably as close as a universal man as any person in our time. Certainly he was a master of Talmud, of every aspect of Jewish thought, of mysticism, of halacha, of drash, of Agoda, and the Rav is certainly very much ensconced in Jewish philosophic tradition as well. I recall having read an analysis of the Rav's thought in 1966-1967, Eugene Borowitz, one of the Reform leaders, wrote a critique of the contemporary thinkers. And he writes of the Rav the following. He says, he's more halachic than Beck, more sophisticated than Kaplan, more erudite than Buber, more rationalistic than Heschel. Felt quite good. But what it says, actually, more than the particular evaluation of the Rav, is that Rav Soloveitchik can understand him as a totality, not simply as a Rosh Yeshiva, as a man behind the desk of the Yeshiva, but as a man of letters who ranks among the foremost Jewish thinkers of the 20th century. That also is the Rav. It's probably an aspect of the Rav that most of the Talmidim of the Rav were not zoche to really absorb, perhaps a bit here and there. And again, I include myself among that group as well. But that dimension of his talk, of his thoughts, of his writings, it certainly should be our interest and our understanding as well. I just want to devote the lecture to rather obvious, to things that are not, to my mind, any chidushim, but some of the main themes of the philosophic mindset of the Rav. And one term, perhaps, I would say is not appropriate is the term the theologian, as opposed to philosophy. Again, those who read Yiddish, and my mother Shlita taught me Yiddish, and for one purpose, I could understand the Rav Shiur. And so I used to read with her the forewords, and later on the Allgemeine. So in 1987, there appeared an article by Hillel Zeidman, and he relates a conversation he had with the Rav in 1963. During the fervor of interfaith dialogue, ecumenism, the liberalization of the church, at the time of great movement, especially among Reform and Conservative leadership, that Jews engaged the church in dialogue, in discussion, interdenominational, interreligious discourse. The Rav was opposed to it, and through various intermediaries, there was a meeting that was set up between Rabbi Soloveitchik, and I think the Cardinal's name at the time was Cardinal Hildebrand. He was the, again, I could be mistaken regarding his proper title, the leader of the Secretariat of the Propagation of the Faith, something along those lines. Based on political and other considerations, the meeting was held on neutral grounds, and not in Yeshiva University, not in YU, in the Hilton Hotel in New York. The fear was that if it will become public, it will be misconstrued as being in favor of interfaith dialogue. There's a well-known addendum, for those who are interested, in an article that was published in Tradition initially many years ago in Consultation, taken from the RCA record, the Biblical Council of America record, on the Rav position on ecumenism, on ecumenical dialogue. Essentially, the Rav argues that there are areas, clearly, that we have in common with the world at large, and those areas we should make a contribution, be it in the areas of economic realm, social realm, etc., etc. Mashen came in contradistinction to the areas of theology. Clearly, our theology is unique, is distinctive, and there, the Rav says that there's no possibility for any kind of ecumenical dialogue. Anyway, in the context of this particular meeting, the Cardinal, one of our Soloveitchik, said that whom are the Jewish theologians who are going to speak? But more to the point, he said, while there is a Christian theology, there's no Jewish theology. There's no theology to talk about. He has nothing to say. Tell me what the Rav meant was that while Christianity, which is primarily doctrine-oriented, and certainly has developed throughout the ages systematic thinking and systematic positions and any number of issues of great moment to religion, Judaism has no theology. We have halacha. And the Rav Kisader writes this in many of his articles, in many of his drushes. If you read the halachic line, this is very clear. Again, another classic essay. We have no theology to speak of. Primarily, if you will, we're more orthodox than orthodox. And while therefore it's inappropriate, I believe, to speak of the Rav as a theologian, what he speaks to us is about Jewish thought and Jewish perspective, the meaning of halacha, the underpinnings of it, and the philosophic ramifications of halacha. But not so much theology, more so, as I said, perhaps philosophic positions Rav Soloveitchik developed in the course of many, many years. And what we're talking about is a focus of ideas on the nature of man, on the philosophy of halacha as it relates to the nature of man. The focus is on the human personality, if you will, more specifically, the religious personality. Or as the Rav would describe it, homo religiosus. That's the focus of Rav Soloveitchik's thought in many of his essays, writings, and drashas. So from there, the Rav derives ideas and notions about God, about the Jewish people, about halacha, about Torah, about the purpose of life, the meaning of religion. The style of writing that Rav Soloveitchik uses is a very specific style of philosophic writing. To use a technical term, it's called phenomenology. And it's a style of philosophic writing that developed in the 20th century, which doesn't really answer or pose questions. It doesn't deal with abstract issues. Phenomenology primarily seeks to describe. The task of the phenomenologist, or the philosopher who works in this particular field, is to evoke and to describe as comprehensively as he possibly can that which he wishes to address. And within phenomenology, there's a branch that says, if you want to discuss the real important issues that philosophers should address, then the focus of your concern should be being, should be man, should be existence. And there are well-known phenomenologists that are Soloveitchik often quoted, people like Heidegger, Schiller, some of the great philosophers of the 20th century. Within phenomenology, there's a sub-style of thought that says, if you want to describe something, in order to make it as clear and definitive as you possibly can, you have to couch it in the framework of an ideal type. You have to describe the ideal of that particular phenomenon. And that's called psychology. You describe not being, not the issue as it really is, but you describe the ideal type, how it ought to be, how it should be. And once you describe that, you succeed in conveying to your audience, either by evocation or by utilizing mastery of the written word, that which you want to express. So the philosophy of the Rav, again, if you read, and lately there's been a spate of books, Baruch Hashem, that have appeared, including the philosophy of prayer, World Without Suffering, and Family Redeemed. These are essays in English, or drasha of Rav Soloveitchik. And one sees clearly throughout these works, I read them actually recently on the plane coming back from St. Louis, the philosophy of the Rav is really a phenomenology of the religious personality. The question is why the Rav utilizes this kind of style. I think there are two reasons I would suggest. One is, the Rav does not start where philosophers usually start with a question. The Rav has issues, basic issues that he accepts. The Muskal Rishon, prima facie, premises. The Rav's task as a philosopher and thinker is to describe and convey to his audience as clearly as he possibly can the nature of man and what man ought to strive for. To explain, to describe what his existence is all about. The answers we know. The answers we know from the Torah. The answers we know from Halacha. We have what the Rav would describe, what philosophers call a priori knowledge, if you wish. The task is not to discover new things, but to understand that which exists. And so too, to see this is very clear, for example, in Isha Halakha, where the Rav describes halachic man. Halachic man, he says, is not overly curious, is not particularly concerned. He's talking here about the issue of mikvah and the like. When halachic man approaches a real spring, he gazes at it and carefully examines its nature. He possesses a priori, ideal principles and precepts, which establish the character of the spring as a halachic construct. And he uses the statutes for the purpose of determining normative law. Does the real spring correspond to the requirements of ideal halakha or not? Halakhic man is not overly curious, and is not particularly concerned with cognizing the spring as it is in itself. Rather, he desires to coordinate the a priori concept with the a posteriori phenomena. And he gives an example. When a halakhic man looks to the western horizon and sees the fading rays of the setting sun, or to the eastern horizon and sees the first light of dawn and the glowing rays of the rising sun, he knows that this sunset or sunrise imposes on him the new obligations and commandments. And he refers to Kriyat Shema, Tzitzit, Tzillin, etc., the Chulah, the Chulah. And he writes, when a halachic man chances upon mighty mountains, he utilizes the measurements which determine the private domain, a sloping mound that attains the height of 10 handbreadths and the distance of 4 cubits. When he sees trees, plants, and animals, he classifies them according to their species and genera. Many laws are dependent upon the classification of the species. The Chulah, the Chulah. And at the end he writes, halachic man explores every nook and cranny of physical biological existence. He determines the character of all the animal functions of man, eating, sexuality, all the bodily necessities, by means of halachic principles and standards. The bulk of an aluk, kazayit, the bulk of the day, potevet, the time required to eat half a loaf meal, kidachil pas, the time required to drink a quarter loaf, rubiit, bechulah bechulah. Halachic concerns itself with the normal as well as abnormal functioning of the organism, with the total biological functioning of the organism. There is no real phenomena to which halachic man does not possess a fixed relationship from the outset and a clear, definitive, a priori orientation. He's interested in sociological creations, the state, society, and the relationship of individuals within the communal context. The halakha encompasses laws of businesses, torts, neighbors, plaintiff, defendant, creditor, and debtor, partners, agents, workers, artisans, bailies, etc., family life, are all clarified and elucidated by it. Halakha has a fixed a priori relationship to the whole of reality, in all of its fine and detailed particulars. Halakhic man orients himself to the entire cosmos, and tries to understand it by utilizing an ideal world which he bears in his halakhic consciousness. All halakhic concepts are a priori, and it's through them that halakhic man looks at the world. And therefore, Rav Soloveitchik, essentially, his philosophy does not consist of proofs. Religion does not stand on or fall on rational proofs, but rather religion is part of an experience. That's one reason why he uses this kind of style, namely the style of a phenomenologist. But secondly, his emphasis on phenomenology, I believe, emanates from his Talmudic tradition as well. Essentially, the Brisker tradition is to clarify Shitot of Rishonim, and the idea is to try to convey the conceptual framework of each particular Shita. In a sense, the Brisker tradition is a phenomenology of Shitot. So for him to extrapolate from his Talmudic training to a philosophic orientation, this style of phenomenology fits very well. The main focus of Rav Soloveitchik's attention is the nature of man, an issue that confronted philosophy from the beginning of time. The major issue perhaps can be framed using the following mashal, the following example. Around the turn of the century, when Harvard University built a new building or hall of philosophy, the president of Harvard University, President Ely, who is the architect of the modern Harvard University, he built it into the major institution that it is. He called a faculty meeting and said, "We're completing the new building of philosophy over the summer, and we should have something appropriate that's engraved over the etching of the hall." He put forth to the faculty and queried them as to the most appropriate citation, which would reflect the philosophic enterprise they're about to engage in. They debated and discussed and thought. They concluded the most appropriate citation is, quote, "Man is the measure of all things." And so it was decided. In the fall, when they returned, they looked at the entryway to the Hall of Philosophy, and lo and behold, instead of finding that citation, "Man is the measure of all things," they found, quote, "What is man that thou art mindful of him? Ma adam batedayim, ben adam batchashvei." This, in a way, summarizes the poles and positions taken by philosophers from the times of classical philosophy, the Greeks, all the way to the sleep of Western civilization, and that's what is known as philosophical anthropology, the nature of man and philosophy. The Greeks, and here we're going to embark on a 2.5-minute survey of all philosophy. The Greeks had the notion of man is the measure of all things. They speak of rational man, reasonable man. In the Christian and medieval period, they speak of evil man, of corrupt man. In the 17th and 18th century, the emphasis on rational man, I think, therefore I am, Descartes. Empiricism, quantifying science, man becomes that being can perceive and know everything. And so it came through the 16th and 17th century, where Immanuel Kant appears, and while part of this tradition, he says that man can think and perceive and know, but it's important to understand that which man perceives as scientific man is not necessarily nature as it exists. It's our perception of nature. That doesn't mean that it's reality. A Martian, obviously with his antenna, will see reality in a totally different kind of fashion. That may be just as accurate perception of reality as the one that we see. However, what we see works, and with the ability of mathematics and modern science to construe and interpret natural law, we accept that, and we use it as a functional tool, but it's not necessarily reality. Man creates his own constructs, but don't misconstrue that as an expression of reality. And then we have the 20th century taking over from the thrust of rational man. What develops is the preeminent style of thought in the modern time, a new style of thought, the emphasis on irrational man. Beginning in the 1890s with Kierkegaard and Nietzsche, with Freud discovering the subconscious, you have in the beginning of the 20th century a whole school of thought called existentialism. All this was just in order to introduce the philosophy of Rav Soloveitchik. The emphasis on the nature of being in a tragic way. Man, in terms of his reason, that cannot speak to the basic needs of man. Man is more than reason. You can be rational, but that will not give you the self-awareness and self-understanding to relieve you of your anxiety, to make you a better person. And even within existentialism, there are a number of different approaches once you have a pessimistic view of man. There are two approaches. One is an atheistic existentialism, life is absurd, a la Camus, or a religious trend in existentialism, and obviously Rav Soloveitchik adopts this particular position. If reason cannot give you answers, where do you seek answers? The answer is, answers come from faith, from God, and not reason. And that's a whole school of thought in and of itself. This discussion is important, as I said, in order to know
the backdrop, to place before the Rav within the proper kind of framework. So what I'd like to do tonight is just focus on three themes that I believe are very common throughout Rav Soloveitchik's writings, essays, brush-offs, and on those I'm going to discuss. Again, as I said, I'm not going to introduce here Chidushim. I think they're rather evident, anyone who's familiar with his writings, and I've read from out everything that the Rav that's been published in the last, as well, the last number of years. And they are, one theme is the creativity of man, the second theme is the duality of man, and the third theme is what I call, what Rav Soloveitchik describes as ethical man versus aesthetic man. The three very fundamental themes in the thought and writings of the Rav. Let's take the first, creativity of man, and explore it a little bit. We're all familiar with the first Rashi, in Sefer Bereishit. Pasuk Bereishit Bara Elokim Es HaShemayim Es HaAretz. Rashi asks why the Torah begins with Bereishit, but logically, the Torah is a cognitive document, should begin with the Pesukim in Pashit Bo, Achod Yisrael Lachem Rosh Chodoshim. And Rashi's answer is also a well-known answer to teach us the dominion of the Almighty over the world, so no one will say that we are essentially thieves and robbers. The Almighty is a ruler, as a sovereign being, determined that Eretz Yisrael belongs to us, he can do with it as he chooses. The Rav is a different approach, and the Rav's approach is, there's a principle of Jewish thought, Halach to Bidrocha, the Gemara Masechet Sota, Chazal elsewhere, a concept of imitatio Dei. Ma'um rachum atatokan rachum, just as the Almighty is merciful, you should be merciful. Ma'um avakar cholim, the Almighty visits the sick, you should visit the sick. Emulating the Almighty. God demonstrates this in many ways. These are the attributes of the Almighty, and we should emulate the attributes of the Almighty. So too, says the Rav, why does the Torah begin with Bereishit? Just as the Almighty is the Borei Olamot, the Almighty is the Creator, the Almighty is the Yotzer, so too the mandate for man is to be a creative agent. A Yotzer, a Shutav, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Master Bereishit. Creativity, therefore, for the Rav, is the most fundamental principle of all principles. Essentially, man has to create himself. This theme is pervasive throughout his writings. You read the Sefer Alav Tshuva, and I heard 13 Tshuvas Drasha from the Rav in the course of 13 years. It's very clear that the main theme of the Rav's Drasha Tshuva is the ability of man to take life into his own hands, to reach out and change direction, to create himself, or if you will, recreate himself. The Rav is very fond of the Rambam in Perek Zayin Hilchot Tshuva. The Rambam describes, the Rambam contrasts man prior to his doing Tshuva and man post Tshuva. Emesh, the Rambam says, yesterday, Hoyazeh, Miruchak, Mituav. The person was distant, the person was estranged from the Almighty. Bayom Ahu bin Nechma v'yidid, today he's become a friend, intimate confidant of the Almighty. As well, the work of the Rav in the 1956 was initially delivered as a speech on Yom HaTzmaut called the Lidofek, where the Rav speaks of the Ish Hamin, man as a species contrasted with Ish Elokim, God endowed man. Or in the middle of the article, Ish HaGoral, fated man, subject to the whims of fate, as opposed to Ish HaYehud, man of destiny, who fashions and forms his own destiny and direction. To give you a sample of those two types, the typology Ish HaGoral as opposed to Ish HaYehud, the Rav writes over there, I quote, what is the nature of the covenant of fate? Fate is the life of a people, as in the life of an individual, signifies an existence of compulsion. The individual, against his will, is subjected and subjugated to the national fate-laden reality. The sense of a fate-laden existence of necessity gives rise to the historical loneliness of the Jew. He is alone both in life and in death. The impressive sense of fate undergoes a positive transformation when individual and personal existences blend together to form a new unit, the people. The obligation to love one another stems from the consciousness of this people of faith, the lonely people that inquires into the meaning of its own uniqueness. In contrast stands the nature of the covenant of destiny. What is the nature of the covenant of destiny? Destiny is the life of a people, as in the life of an individual, signifies a deliberate and conscious existence that the people have chosen out of its own free will, and in which it finds the full realization of its historical being. When the man of destiny confronts God, he beholds the God of Israel, who reveals himself to man only with his covenant and at his invitation. The God of Israel enters into a relationship with finite, creaturely man, only after the latter has sanctified and purified himself from all uncleanliness and pollution, and awaits with passion and longing the wondrous encounter with his Creator. Perhaps the element of creativity is seen in full bloom with the Rav's major work in the 1940s, the Ish HaLacha, translated by Professor Kaplan of McGill University in Montreal, that really, I believe, captures the mood and spirit of the original Hebrew, and renders a very difficult article into a manageable English, perhaps. Isha Halakha, for many years, was the only work that the Rav published, and based on that, his reputation was established. Isha Halakha is a classic piece of phenomenology. To quote Eugene Burroughs again, he labeled this article a misnagdic phenomenology of awesome proportions. The intent of the work is to describe the nature of the Isha Halakha, and in so doing, Rabbi Soloveitchik differentiates between Isha Hadat, cognitive man of science, man of the world, mathematician and scientist, and the Ish Hadat, the religious personality. The Rav suggests the Ish Halakha is distinct from both of these types. He has his own unique framework. The central thesis of this work is the correlation between halakhic man, if you will, and the modern mathematician or scientist. Let me just read you. A selection. Regarding that aspect. Halakhic man, his worldview is similar to that of the mathematician, a priori and ideal. Both the mathematician and halakhist gaze at the concrete world from an a priori ideal standpoint, using a priori categories and concepts which determine from the outset their relationship to the qualitative phenomena they encounter. Halakhic man's ideal is the subject reality to the yoke of the halakha. Such also is the way of the mathematician. When Riemann and Lobachevsky discovered the possibility of a non-Euclidean space, they did not pay any attention to the existential space in which we all live and which we encounter with all our senses, which is Euclidean from beginning to end. They were concerned with an ideal mathematical construct, and that ideal world, they discerned certain features of a geometric space different from ours. Afterwards, physicists such as Einstein and his circle appeared, and they utilize the concept of a non-Euclidean space in order to explain certain physical phenomena. The ideal geometric space then found its actualization in the real world. So therefore, just as contemporary mathematics and science is not just simply an expression of reality, a scientist develops concepts and equations, a mathematician develops language and linguistics tools for him to operate, to understand nature, an a priori system unto itself, so too the halakha in a similar kind of fashion. The essence of halakha is to create an ideal world, and the perceptual relations that exist between it and reality in all of its manifestations. There's no phenomenon or event for which the a prioristic halakha does not have an idealistic stance and judgment. And that's what the Rav says any number of times. One of the most fascinating comments the Rav makes regarding his grandfather, Rav Chaim Mabrisk, is to say that Rav Chaim's contribution to the world of Lundus is equivalent to the Galilean Newtonian revolution in the world of science. In other words, till modern science, what did scientists do? They looked at the universe, they classified, they described, they interpreted positivism, Francis Bacon, empiricism. What Rav Chaim did was to extrapolate from a variety of sectors of halakha, basic broad principles, and not only categorize each area independently, but he built conceptual structures and then applied them to the different systems he wanted to address. I heard that when we learned Jardin, he said that what Rav Chaim did was he took a top and a level, he took a pot and a pan, spoons and forks, and categorized them conceptually. He took the sitter out of the hands of the shamoshim and gaboyim, and, not still of course, and transformed it into conceptual instruments. That's modern science. Not necessarily reality as it exists, but it doesn't have to be, because science is not either. Here you can see the Kantian influence, and indeed the Rebbe in Berlin wrote his doctoral dissertation on the thought of Hermann Cohen, one of the major neo-Kantians at the time. So there's a great influence on the great creative scientific category of halakha. How does halakhic man approach, for example, the sunset of Yom Kippur? One of the most beautiful sections, our Soloveitchik describes how going out, let's read you this particular section. I remember how once on the Day of Atonement, I went outside into the synagogue courtyard with my father, Moshe Soloveitchik, just before the Me'ilah service. It had been a fresh, clear day, one of the fine, almost delicate days of summer's end, filled with sunshine and light. Evening was fast approaching, and an exquisite autumn sun was sinking into the west, beyond the trees of the cemetery, into a sea of purple and gold. Rav Moshe, halachic man par excellence, turned to me and said, "This sunset differs from ordinary sunset, for with it forgiveness is bestowed upon us for our sins. The Day of Atonement and the forgiveness of sins merged and blended here with the splendor and beauty of the world, and with the hidden lawfulness of the order of creation, and the whole was transformed into one living, holy, cosmic phenomenon." God's granting us atonement. Is atonement there? It's sunset like any other day. But our a priori postulate enables us to see something different in that sunset of Yom Kippur. So too the Isha Halacha is the Yotzer. And again, to draw your attention to another paragraph where the Rav speaks of the difference between mystical man and halachic man. He writes over here that the scientist, the creator, and the religious man thirst for the living God, ascends to the Almighty. God, however, descends to halachic man. And also through halacha, you take the transcendent and bring it down to this world. You endow reality with holiness and kedusha. He writes over here, home of religiosis who thirsts for the living God demolishes the bounds of this worldliness, transforms himself into pure spirit, breaks through all barriers and ascends on high. For him, the approach to God consists in a leap from the empirical and concrete into the transcendent and the mysterious. Not so halachic man. When his soul yearns for God, he immerses himself in reality, plunges with his entire being into the very midst of concrete existence, and petitions to God to ascend upon the mountain and dwell within our reality with all its laws and principles. Homer with the geosis ascends to God. God, however, descends to halachic man. The latter desires not to transform finitude into infinity, but rather infinity into finitude. He brings down the divine presence into a sanctuary bounded by 20 boards, holding this into a world situated within the realms of concrete reality, the absolute into the relative and the conditional. Transcendence becomes embodied in man's deeds, deeds that are shaped by the lawful physical order of which man is a part. The idea of holiness according to halachic world and halachic man view does not signify a transcendent realm completely separate and removed from reality. And this is a fundamental distinction that the Rav has between the Isha Halacha and the Isha Dat, Omer Gugiosis, or if you will, the mystical personality. Again, the Rav is talking in ideal types. In reality, the Isha Halacha is much more complicated, but this is the ideal typology that the Rav describes. Again, in terms of creativity, maybe Kantian in origin, but it also reflects the Brisker tradition as well. It's well known that Rav Chaim was not actively engaged in Psach. The Brisk is the famous Dayan of Simcha Zelig Riga. Those of you who study Yeshiva Resi may have studied under his son. He taught Bible, Professor Riga. There's a discussion in the Torah, in Torah circles, regarding Rav Chaim's reluctance to engage in Psach. Some people are of the opinion that Rav Chaim had a lot of difficulty making the decision. Some have accused the Rav of a similar kind of situation. That the Rav and his grandfather and members of his family in general could convince themselves so well of the rector to the one position, the next day of the second position, the third day of the third position. Allah, you're right, I could both be right, you're right too. Rav Zevin has in his famous sefer, a tremendous sefer, I recommend highly, Ishim B'Shitot, he has an analysis of a number of Gedolei Yisrael. In his analysis of Rav Chaim Brisker, he notes, it did not emanate from indecisiveness, his reluctance to the issue of Psach, but on the contrary, because of the intellectual boldness of Rav Chaim that could brook no intellectual dishonesty. Boldness not pejoratively, but the courage of his convictions as he understood them. And therefore the issue was decided based on originality of thought, and it meant that the halacha was based not only on precedent necessarily, Rav Chaim had difficulty limiting himself to precedent. And so in his boldness of toppling tradition, rather than undermine precedent in halacha, he withdrew from active involvement in Psach and left it to Simcha Zelig. So Rav Zevin understands this reluctance of Rav Chaim to engage in Psach. But certainly it was not his indecisiveness, but rather a thrust of creativity and learning that led him into new areas and to new dimensions. So creativity, it seems to me, represents one of the salient and fundamental aspects of our Soloveitchik thinking. I've told the story a number of times. I suspect it's apocryphal, but it's a great story. There's a doctor who actually ministered to Rabbi Soloveitchik. He's in Queens. Probably some of you know him. Alan Goldstein. My brother's his accountant. So I should really check the story with him, but I haven't had a chance to. And I spoke to him many, many times. He used to sit actually behind me and Maria for 13 years. I said, I was sure of Maria for 13 years. And Dr. Goldstein was there many more years than I was. Anyway, as the story is told, when he finished medical school, or perhaps in medical school, he didn't know which area of medicine to specialize in. So he decided to ask three Gedolei Yisrael. He asked Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and the Rav Zichronu Livracha. And apparently each one told him a different answer. But the answers are just so classic and so much reflect the pre-persona that we're talking about that this story to me is absolutely striking. Now Moshe told him, choose an area of specialty that you'll have the least problems with Shabbos. You'll be able to observe Shabbos. As a matter of fact, probably many of you know, in my days, many of my colleagues became radiologists. Radiology was the field, actually, where one would more or less not be involved with Chil Shabbos. Today, radiology has changed drastically. It's a totally different field. And today, radiology really is one of the major fields in medicine. But then, radiology was more or less confined to during the week. And that's what he told him to do. And I think he even suggested to him some other areas as well, but areas that would not be problematic in terms of Chilul Shabbos. He asked the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the fellow of the Bracha, and he told him, go to a specialty which enhances the quality of Adam L'Chaveiro. You'll be able to enhance the quality of human life in terms of interaction with other human beings. I think he suggested to become a dermatologist. This way, one would feel better about himself, heighten their self-esteem, etc. I assume the cosmetic aspect of dermatology, don't exactly know the specifics there. The person would feel more at ease, more positive, more self-fulfilled. He went to the Rav, and the Rav told him, enter the area of medicine where you will advance and push forward the frontiers of medicine. That's what you should be. And the Rav told him, based on the pasuk, that the Gemara Dashim, the Kifshua Sheti Esig the Yeshua Shalayla. The Rav has the Raivin, he's very fond of quoting, the Raivin is Bagdoma, to save the Tarata Nefesh. The Raivin is the Sefer Amido, that the Rav contended, I heard him say this 3 or 4 times, I get to see the Raivin, I don't see it in the words of the Raivid. But the Rav understood the Raivid. He knew how to read between the lines, and I did not. And the Rav understood the Raivid. That's the human capacity for creativity. One should be in the forefront, developing the science and technology, and that's where one should pursue dafka, that particular area. As a matter of fact, in another well-known essay, Tifasis, the Rav discusses this matter. I'll just read part of it. The Rav there talks about the obligation of an individual to engage in kibush, and at the same time recognize that he cannot conquer everything and he has to retreat. He says here, the halacha was cognizant of the program the Creator set for man. By man was called upon to defy opposition on the part of nature and march to victory. Biblical man is out to subdue his environment. Yet when conquest is within man's reach and the road to realization has been cleared of all hindrances, man victor, who needs only to reach out and grab everything his heart has actually desired, must change his course and begin to withdraw. When victory is near, man must invite defeat and surrender the spoils they had quested for so long. The movement is dialectical in nature. Forward march ends in retreat, which in turn leads to a resumption of forward march. After man withdraws from the position which he has acquired through hard labor and sacrifice, he begins once again to swing forward. Again, halakha encourages man to pursue greatness and vastness, to experiment daringly with his liberties, to search feverishly for dominion, and again, halakha commands man bolt about face. This dialectical movement, no matter how incomprehensible to modern man, forms the very heart of halakhic living. In other words, halakha teaches man how to conquer and how to lose, how to seize initiative and how to renounce, how to succeed, how to invite defeat, and how to resume the striving for victory, marching forward. I mentioned the story of the three Gedolim, not to compare Gedolim Yisrael, but to demonstrate the passion that the Rav had with creativity, the human capacity of being in the forefront. And this is very much reflected in the Rav's classic piece, Isha Halakha, and that, I believe, is probably one of the major themes that Rav Soloveitchik has, the notion of creativity. Mahu borei olamo, afata borei olamo. Mahu yotzer, afata yotzer. Mahu mechadesh, afata mechadesh. Undoubtedly, this is a very central theme in Rav Soloveitchik's thinking. A second theme I wanted to focus on a few moments is the emphasis on the duality of man. I believe it's markedly different from the Greek and Christian concept of duality. There's a tradition in Greek and medieval Christian thought there's a duality in man, namely the duality of body and soul. The soul is a prisoner of the body, and the body is but a repository for the soul. In the time of the fall of man, according to Christian doctrine, there was this gap between body and soul, with the body dragging the soul down. That's not the duality that Soloveitchik is talking about. For him, the duality of man is within two existential experiences within the religious dimension of man. For him, duality is not a secondary theme, but an intrinsic part of creation. There's dialectics, or poles, if you will, within man. Man oscillates to and fro. For Judaism, there's what the Rav used to call the multi-valued logic system. It's not simply A and B, but rather, I should say, not A or B, but rather A and B, simultaneously. I remember one year, I think in the late 60s, when International Relations Society of Yeshiva University invited, I think his name was Lord Carradine, he was the British ambassador to the UN at the time, to address the International Relations Society Club. At that time, Britain had voted in some dastardly fashion against Israel. Actually, recently they've had some no major changes in that respect. Nothing has changed in life. There was a great tumult on the campus. Question was, should we permit Lord Carrier to speak or not to speak? And I remember Beitar had a major demonstration against Lord Carrier. They almost actually stopped the entire university. The issue went to Rav Soloveitchik, and the Rav proceeded to give a 3-hour address in the Reuben Shul. And I recall I understood nothing of it. The basic issue, if I recall correctly, the Rav said, you've sent an invitation, be a mensch, invite the fellow, what's the problem? And that's it. But that wasn't the bulk of the lecture. The bulk of the lecture, the one Rav went on for 3 hours to discuss, I remember, dialectics of Jewish history. In terms of pulls of multi-valued logic, ultimately getting down to the issue of when you stand up and fight, when you accommodate, when you listen, a major lecture on dialectics. At the end, he convinced the student body to be respectful and to accept Lord Carrier in the appropriate fashion. If I'm not mistaken, 2 or 3 days later, Lord Carrier called and said he wasn't able to make it. Meanwhile, we got a lecture on dialectics and the laws of the excluded middle. So this notion of duality and a major statement of duality in Jewish thought appears in the Rav's, what I think is the most profound essay the Rav ever published and wrote, and that is Lowly Man of Faith. But he argued that the others disagree. There the Rav has a notion, duality of man. The concept of dualism, as you know, is of course not far from the Brisker tradition either. Tukiyumin, Gabriel Chetzer, Maisa Mitzah, Kima Mitzah. Once again, the world of Talmudic background and philosophical orientation meet as well. In terms of the Lowly Man of Faith, the springboard for this discussion, of course, is Bereshit. And again, I'm not telling you any chidushim here. One of the major problems in biblical interpretation is the twice repeated story of the creation of man, both in chapter 1 and chapter 2, Perek Aleph and Perek Bet of Bereshit. And the second recounting is somewhat different than the first recounting. The question is why? And that's what the Rav explores in a number of articles, primarily in Lowly Man of Faith, but elsewhere as well. By the way, there exists today, it was published already many years ago by Avraham Bezdin, Zichron Livracha. Those of you who may have had some contact with Avraham Bezdin, his brother from JSS, Zichron Livracha, so he had a brother with the Rav, Avraham Bezdin, and he published 2 volumes called Reflections of the Rav. I call them the I remember in my days when people didn't want to read the entire piece of literature, so there was something called Monarch Notes. Reflections of the Rav are the Monarch Notes for Rav Soloveitchik's article. So those who don't have the patience or the capacity or the wherewithal to sit through 60, 70, 80 pages of an essay can read Reflections of the Rav, where more or less he summarizes the two Adams, Adam 1 and Adam 2, Adam A and Adam B, and more or less has a large part of the Lowly Man of Faith that appears over there. But the springboard, as I said, is Dafka here at Sefer Bereishit. By the way, Chazal were aware of this problem, the fact that the Rav discovered America, and that no one else actually approached this problem prior to the Rav. Uzari and Ramban, many of you shouldn't really deal with this issue. However, even modern biblical criticism in the documentary Hypothesis also, of course, addresses this issue. They come to, shall we say, rather different conclusions regarding this particular matter. But the Rav offers an original, what I think is a very profound interpretation that has enormous applications for his philosophy. Just briefly, if I may, in Perek Aleph of Bereishit, Rav Soloveitchik notes, there are really 4 major discrepancies between the 2 accounts. Man's formation, here in Perek Aleph of Bereishit, man was created by Yibro Elokim et Adam et Tzalmo, et Tzalmo Elokim bara uto, Zachar and Kibah bara utam. Man was created by Tzalmo Elokim, we're not informed how his body was formed. In Perek Bet of Bereishit, man was fashioned by Yitzha Hashem Elokim et Adam, Afar min Adamah. With God breathing into him the breath of life. That's one distinction. A second distinction relates to the assignment of man. Adam 1 received the mandate from the Almighty, Milu et Ha'aretz Kivshua, that I mentioned earlier. Subdue the earth and have dominion over it. Adam 2 was charged with the obligation to cultivate the earth and to guard it. Third distinction in terms of the relationship between Adam and Chava. Other than Chavah, the story of Adam 1, both sexes were created concurrently. Thus it says, Zacharun Kevah, Bara Utah. In the case of Adam 2, he emerged alone, with Chavah appearing subsequently as his helpmate. And fourthly, the major distinction that the Rishonim focused on, the first account, only the Shem Elohim appears. In the second account, Elohim, of course, is used in conjunction with the Shem Hashem. And you'll read the Pesukim, you see the distinction between Adam 1 and Adam 2, fairly obvious. All these distinctions, the question is, what does it mean? The Rav's interpretation is that we have 2 typologies, 2 creations, representing 2 dimensions of man, if you will, 2 ideal types, Adam 1, he describes him as majestic man, Tzelem Elokim, just as God is created, man should be created, but his primary mandate is Yeshua, dominating nature, creating a more comfortable life, dignified existence, utilizing science and beauty. And the Rav describes here, the lonely man of faith, Adam 1 being bold and aggressive and victory-minded. His motto is success. Adam 1 again, Zachron Nekeva Bara Utam, not Siamese twins, but rather a functional, pragmatic kind of yachas between husband and wife. Again, the bottom line is enhanced as a result of the union between husband and wife. That's the Adam 1 perception of a wife. More pragmatic have a division of labor. A relationship with women emanates not from Loto Mayota Adam Levados, in the case of Adam 2, but better to create a society. You have your job, I have my job, and of course, as I said, the bottom line is enhanced. More productive, more constructive. Hashem came, the second Adam, of course, Afamin Hadamah, created alone, aware of his creatureliness, of his humbleness. He's overwhelmed by the cosmos, he's aware of his existence, which is unique in death kind of experience. For him to be is to be singular, to be different, consequently lonely. For him, the looking at nature and saying, how he looks at nature, why do I exist, what purpose is there, what am I doing? Loneliness and insecurity are part of Adam too. He has a quest not for dominion, but for redemption. To overcome his loneliness, to communicate with others, to be able to relate to a personal God. When dignity is acquired, when man triumphs over nature, redemption occurs, says the Rav. Then man is overpowered by nature. Dignity is discovered with success. Redemption is discovered with crisis and failure. So Adam too has this issue, existential issue, of anxiety, loneliness, isolation, insecurity. His point of departure, unlike Adam 1, is not utilitarian, not pragmatic. He's looking to gain awareness of himself, to relate essentially to someone else. And for this he creates what the Rav became very fond of, a term that he, I think, utilized excessively, the covenantal community. I, thou, and he. When God comes into the picture, it helps him redeem himself. And therefore the Rav goes on to describe in Lonely Man of Faith the two genres of encounter, prophetic encounter as opposed to the prayer encounter, prophetic encounter when God speaks to man, the prayer encounter when man speaks to God. A covenantal community is created, thereby man takes a leap, relates existentially to another human being, from this emerges the covenantal community dafka as a result of Adam number 2. By the way, I must be honest, at Tatoya Nimaskir, the Rav used to go to many Sherev Brachot, and I accompanied him, even though I wasn't invited to the Sherev Brachot, but I knew the Rav was going to speak, and my interest was in listening to Rav Soloveitchik, what Russia he had to say in the Sherev Brachot. Sometimes it's a little bit uncomfortable, when going to someone's home when you're not invited, but somehow I was able to somehow insinuate myself into the home. And very often the Rav spoke about the two brachot that repeat themselves: the bracha of Yotzer Adam, the first, and then the subsequent bracha, also Yotzer Adam, which has a longer hakdama, a longer preamble, based on the Gemara in the first paragraph, Masechet Tuvot. Asher Yatzarat Adam Itzalmo Betzelem Dvut Hadigdo Veitkilon Menena Bidyan Adayah Baruch Hashem Yotzer Adam. The first bracha is rather short, a bracha tzara. And the Rav more or less described these two brachot essentially reflect these two personas, reflect Adam A and Adam B. Also an article in Confrontation, and many other articles, you see the Rav describes these two personas, and I heard at least on 6 or 7 different Sherev Brachot, the Rav actually more or less formulated this idea in a number of different ways. Ultimately, man can never be relieved of his tragic existence. But, as I said, there are two types. And these are the two types that our Soloveitchik describes at some length. A third theme I just wanted to focus on is the thought that the Rav expresses, the conflict between two experiences representing the totality of man. One is the cognitive ethical gesture, that's in sharp contradistinction to the aesthetic experience. The cognitive ethical gesture is definite, clear-cut, and absolute. There is in it an element of adventure, no illusion of boundlessness. It's harnessed to a motor of perseverance, extraordinary patience, ethical laws binding at all times, not affected by whimsical man or whimsical turn of events. The ethical person decides in favor of the norm many times a day, does not become bored or tired of repeating the same act hundreds of times. But like the Rav gives the example, when I come across a burning house where Chas v'Shalom, a helpless child has been trapped, I must hasten to rescue the victim. It would be criminal folly on my part to desist on the grounds I've already saved 5 other children the same day, and I'm bored and tired with this continued climbing and carrying of children overcome by fire. The crux of the ethical norm exhausts itself in the awareness of continuity and constancy. There is no need for change and or recreation. The ethical conscience doesn't have to offer continually new stimuli, new vision, and varied experiences. It realizes itself in one great experience, the fulfillment of one universal law, thou shalt not. In stark contrast to these types, ethical cognitive stands the aesthete, the aesthetic experience. The aesthete expresses his craving for the hedonic, for the sensual. Beauty in the eyes of an ethical man is comprehended. In the eyes of an aesthetic man, it must be apprehended and felt. Aesthetic man who writes lyrics and profound novels, composes music and paints landscapes, builds magnificent structures, not for ethical or theological gain, but exclusively for the sheer pleasure of doing so. The final objective and goal of the aesthete is himself. There is something of the narcissist in every aesthete. He's selfish and egocentric. Form exhausts every creature and creative fiber in his personality. Content is of minimal significance to him. The aesthetic experience is an intoxicating one of self-admiration and adoration. The aesthete, or hedonic man, cannot live in a world of monotony and sterility. He craves for constant thoughts and change. He rejects all objective, fixed, self-repeating experiences and constant searches for the mutable, the new, and the unknown. A concomitant ongoing malady of the aesthete is therefore boredom. The ethicist would find boredom to be an alien experience. I remember a number of times our Soloveitchik, in terms of the particular Gemara that he was learning, there were those in the Shia who wanted him to move to a different parak, or to move to a different topic, and that all for the life of him couldn't understand it. And I remember him saying a number of times, there are no difficult tesisim, and there are no easy tesisim. We used to think that the small ones are relatively easy, and the large ones are relatively difficult. They're often called kumpaket, it's the opposite, that the large ones usually are the easy ones, and the small ones are quite difficult. By the way, he's definitely correct, no question about it. The rubber line of this schism between cognitive ethical man and aesthetic man understood this as being at the heart of the primordial sin of Adam and Chava. And any number of occasions, I've heard the Rav discuss the Ramban, the Ron, the Buchin, and the Ramban in his Perish al HaTorah. The Ramban was asked by a philosopher, how is it possible Adam HaRishon was a Chotei Niskar? As a result of Chet, of transgression, not only was he not punished, but seemingly he emerged victorious and was rewarded with the ability to discriminate between Tov and Ra, as the Nachash had prognosticated. V'yitem kelokim, yodei Tov v'ra. The Ramban answers by distinguishing between two concepts, muskalot and mugashot. Prior to the Chet, Adam traveled exclusively in the realm of the muskalot, utilizing the categories of emek and sheker. Subsequent to the Chet, he was thrust into the world of Tov and Ra. The Rav explained the Chet and downfall of man was his giving preference to Tov and Ra, to the aesthetic, sensuous impulses, that which is delightful and pleasing, over and above the ethical and cognitive gesture. Emek and Sheker are in the ethical realm. Tov and Ra are aesthetic categories. And the Rav proved it from the Sukkim. I don't have time now to discuss it. But the distinction that I've said is manifest in the Sukkim narration. Prior to the Chet, the Torah records, Vayushneam Arumim, Adam Yishto, Velo Yivashashim. Subsequent to the Chet, the Torah states, Vayindu Ki Arumim Heim, Vayitru Alei Teina, Vayasu Lehem Chagorot. The shame of nudity is of an aesthetic origin, not of an ethical nature. In the realm of Emet and Sheker, nudity is not a vice, unless it's associated with immoral sexual activity. The shame of nudity expresses itself in the realm of Tov and Ra, an emotion of aesthetic abhorrence and aversion. The aesthete, said the Rav, suffers from embarrassment, which is basically a relational experience. My hand was found in the cookie jar. I'm embarrassed in the presence of others. Ethical man suffers only from shame, an awareness of my wretchedness or worthlessness, a sense of remorse when I commit a faux pas in the ethical realm. Even in Lashon HaKodesh, the Rav said there are two words that convey these two experiences, busha and klima. To the Chet, Adam HaRishon was a cognitive, ethical being. His aesthetic cravings were subordinate to his overwhelming ethical sense. At the moment of Vatera HaYisha, Kitov HaEitz L'Machal, V'chita Avahu Le'inayim, V'nachmar HaEitz L'Askil, V'atikach Mipuyo V'atuchal, V'atiten Gam Yisha Yimah V'yuchal, V'atipokach Ne'ine Shnei V'yiduk Yomim Heim, man chose to forfeit the ethical and opt for the aesthetic. A loss of such profound magnitude as to be almost indescribable. The consequences of the Chet were catastrophic. Boredom followed in its wake. Boredom does not characterize the ethical experience, but rather the aesthetic one. This is what Adam and Chava discovered after they ate from the Eitz HaDaat. V'tikokach ne'ine shneihem, v'yigdu ki yerumim hem. That their nude and senseless lives were full of absurdity and worthlessness. Boredom is the admission of the meaninglessness of the aesthetic existence, which is non-teleological in nature. The aesthete has no vision. no matter how flamboyant and captivating his momentary sensual enjoyment. It does not promote the idea of self-discovery, self-realization, and self-redemption. The experience, though thrilling and rapturous, leaves him despondent and disillusioned. And this, I believe, is the most exasperating and difficult concept to transmit to a student. The moment the student absorbs this yisod, his or her life are immediately metamorphosed and transformed. This yisod is recurring in Rav Soloveitchik's analysis. Beauty, he writes, is a quality, like any aesthetic gesture, must be redeemed and shown to have transcendental qualities. The Rav on so many occasions analyzed the responses of Shem ben Noach on the one hand and Ham and Yefet on the other hand, as being reflective of these two approaches. Yefet was motivated by aesthetic and aesthetic considerations and covering the nakedness of his father, while Shem was solely motivated by ethical considerations of shame and of the dignity of his father. The encounter with beauty is always tantalizing, but simultaneously a dangerous experience. And I know on a number of occasions the Rav referred to this in a classic piece in Confrontation. The Rav is very fond of this Ramban. He writes over there on page 57 in the Confrontation article, "Beauty uncouth and unrefined, but irresistible, seducing man and contributing to his downfall, emerges in the biblical arena for the first time according to the Midrash quoted by Maimonides in the person of Naamah. And the pasuk of Ba'achol tu Balkayin Naamah, Rabban quotes in Midrash, Acher l'raboteinu shi'a isha hayafa, imod, shemimena ta'u b'nei ha'alokim, or b'nei Elohim, diyan imezeh b'pasuk b'ayu b'nei Elohim et b'not ha'adam." Our sages offered another Midrashic interpretation, that Naamah was the fairest of all women, who seduced the sons of the mighty. It is she who is referred to in that verse. Her seductive charms captivated the sons of the mighty and led to their appalling disregard for the central divine norm enjoining man from reaching out for the fascinating and beautiful that does not belong to him. The sons of the mighty yielded to the hedonic urge and were unable to discipline their actions. They were a non-confronted, non-normative group. They worshipped beauty and succumbed to its overwhelming impact. Naamah, the incarnation of unhallowed and unsublimated beauty, is for the Midrash not so much an individual as an idea. Not only a real person, but a symbol of unredeemed beauty. As such, she appears in the biblical drama in many disguises. At times, her name is Delilah, seducing Shimshon. At other times, she's called Tamar, corrupting a prince. She's cast in the role of a princess or queen, inflicting untold harm upon a holy nation and kingdom of priests, whose king, the wise of all men, abandoned his wisdom when he encountered overpowering beauty. The Book of Wisdom, Proverbs, portrays her as the anonymous woman with an impudent face, who lieth in wait at every corner, and the Agada, cited here by Nachmanides, as the beautiful queen of the demons, tempting man and making him restless. These are three themes that one sees constantly throughout our Soloveitchik's writings. And clearly, I don't believe our Soloveitchik necessarily came to provide us with solutions to many of the issues that he raises. The man of faith is lonely because we live in both planes, in the world of science and the world of covenant and redemption. Another one of his famous drasha was very fond of the notion of ger v'toshav v'nochi imachem. How a Jew has to both live in the world at large, but at the same time maintain his unique, distinctive faith experience. That's the ger v'toshav that work simultaneously. Ultimately, osa shalom in Roma, v'yasa shalom aleinu, this duality will be unified in the end of days. In the meanwhile, the flight of the lonely man continues. Rosh Hashanah used to say, one does not die from the question. What the Rav has done is not necessarily to offer solutions, but rather to portray the plight. In a moving passage in The Lonely Man of Faith, then the Rav also, I'm not going to go into it at this point in time, I've always thought that Rav Soloveitchik, during the years when he operated, especially in the 40s and 50s, when the pressure of the scientific community was so great, and many argued at that time that halakha was outdated and outmoded and meaningless, and the Rav unquestionably defended halakha personality and halakha momentum, to my mind, he essentially saved American Jewry and undoubtedly saved the North American rabbinate to a large extent. Does the Rav necessarily solve problems? I don't think so, but he describes them. I will conclude actually with a story of the Beit HaLevi, and there are a number of different versions of this story. I'll just share the version that I'm aware of. The daughter of the Beis HaLevi, whom Rav Soloveitchik is named after, Rav Sheber, married the son of Chassidus Rebbe. That itself is almost a Neis Nigla. The Biala Rebbe. They didn't have much in common, the two Mechutanim. And the daughter moved to the city of her in-laws. She had a difficult pregnancy. Her life was threatened. And the Beis HaLevi went to spend time in Biala. During the summer months, over Yom Noroyim, Finally, Baruch Hashem, she gave birth, was restored to health. Meanwhile, he was there over Yom Tovim and during the Sukkot Yom Tov. Over the period, he was with the Rebbe, and he saw the Chassidim, as you can imagine, with all their Tishin, the Minehem, and Hashmi Atzeret, Simcha Bet HaShoeva, Simcha Torah, and the Rebbe gesticulating, Chassidim dancing and singing, the overpowering experience of Dvekut Hashem for his fellow man. He returned to Brisk. And subsequently, one of the Chassidim asked the Bialy Rebbe, "What do you think? The Beis Halevi became a Shtikul Chassid after all the time he spent for the Rebbe's dish?" So the Rebbe said, "A Chassid he still did not become. But one thing I'll tell you, he'll never laugh at us again." So too, regarding our Soloveitchik's writings and thoughts, did he prove anything to the scoffer, to the skeptic? Perhaps they'll be inspired, perhaps they'll be uplifted, not necessarily convinced, but one thing I can guarantee you, the scoffer will not laugh at us anymore.